Hi there, this is Michael Koller, the Curious Quant for Conexus Financial. Today I'll be speaking with Gideon Smith from AXA IM Rosenberg Equities. And we'll be discussing about the accounting and economic basis by which quantitative and statistical models have been built to manage money historically over a number of decades, and how that basis might actually be challenged or in some ways changed, evolved perhaps with the advent of more statistical or pattern-seeking systems like machine learning and like broad applications of AI. I really enjoyed this conversation. This is a kind of a true quants conversation about this field, about some of the pragmatic challenges of adapting these new kinds of technologies and data sets. I hope you can join us. Hi there. This is Michael Koller, the Curious Quant for Conexus. And I have the pleasure, the absolute pleasure, to be sitting here with Gideon Smith, the CIO and Global Head of Portfolio Management for AXA IM Rosenberg Equities. Welcome, Gideon.
Hi there, Michael. Good to see you.
Welcome to Sydney, Australia. 27 degrees outside today.
It's very pleasant.
What's it going to be like in London again?
It's very pleasant to be here and not in London at the moment. Thank you.
So Gideon and I go way back, but so it's kind of easy for me in some sense to pick a quirky topic for us to kind of touch on at the beginning to open up. But we both have a somewhat public love of all things kind of geeky in terms of Marvel superhero. We may not be alone anymore, fortunately. I think the rest of the world is caught up in
absolutely
our affection for these things. But I'm going to just put it on the table right now. What is your favorite superhero movie?
Oh, that's tricky, and there's a recency effect that always comes into play, but I very much like the latest incarnation of Spider-Man. So all the most recent Spider-Man movies.
Number four now, I think, what it is?
The second one in the MCU, or the third one in the MCU. It's a good movie. And I have a passion for film, but particularly a passion for special effects and CGI. So part of my background, I spent time as a software developer building special effects software for movies. And so I have an appreciation for good CGI in movies.
And how much I'm sure the field has come along as well.
Absolutely.
It's pretty amazing. So on that note, actually, it says perfect background into your background. So tell me a little bit about how you came to be here at this point in time in your life.
So it is a very disparate career path that took me to where we are today. I started life as an accountant. I didn't know what I wanted to do, and getting sort of a fundamental grounding in accounting seemed like a sensible thing to do. I spent a few years as an accountant in London. I'd studied computer science at university, and back in the day, that was somewhat unusual. That was not the done thing. And then I had an opportunity to go and work, as I said, in the software industry, writing special effects software for movies. And at the time, the economics of that industry were very, very interesting, because you got to charge for your software basically sums that were related to what would it cost to get Arnold Schwarzenegger back into the studio as opposed to fixing things in post-production. So you were able to charge out software for sort of $150,000 for a one-year license. And these days you can buy it for $15 on your phone and do the same sort of editing on your phone that we were doing back in the late 90s. And it was fun. A lot of the industry was moving towards the US, and so at the time I switched to join what was Rosenberg Equities as on the software side, as a software developer. And what attracted me to Rosenberg and potentially them to me was that combination of an accounting background, a fundamental view on companies, as well as the technology. And so I started life at Rosenberg. We were pretty small in London at the time. I was one of the first employees. And we started building the models, building the systems.
And when was that, Gideon? What year?
That was
1998. So that was one of the golden eras of quant, wasn't it?
I think it was just as we hit LCTM, which I think was the first little wobble that the industry had. And also, we're building models that have sort of, as I'm sure you'll appreciate, sort of you're building valuation signals and so on. And as you begin to go into that tech bubble, it was a challenging environment. And it certainly drove us to think about the new sorts of signals that we should be building and so on. But I joined on the technology side. The nice thing about working for a small house is you had the opportunities to do many different things. So I started to get involved on the portfolio management side as well. Did an MBA, did a CFA, and realized that there were people who were far better at doing the technology than me. and potentially even far better at doing some of the investing stuff, but I was able to bridge those worlds and have the technical conversations with the technology people, have some of the investment and accounting-based conversations on the finance side. And as we grew the business, I think it became increasingly important to begin to put a human face on the process. And I very much enjoyed trying to describe what we did to clients and prospects. And so over the years, we grew the business. We got to work together for a few years, you and I. But over time, we've seen how the industry has developed. And I think we're now in that golden age where we've been banging on about data and models and analysis for the best part of 25, 30 years, and finally people are really, really interested in coming to talk to us about our databases and so on.
No, I mean, you're right. In many ways, we are living through a golden age, but it is funny how, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme.
Absolutely.
There's a sense by which there's a reincarnation for why quant is interesting, but it's interesting perhaps for very different reasons. So what do you think is about different about the flavor of this golden age relative to the previous ones that I guess you've worked through?
I guess there's two driving forces that are changing some of those conversations. So one is the change in the nature of data and information. So for many, many years, we would build our models built around the accounting information that was available to us, sometimes earnings information, and you're looking for more and more insights. But essentially, it was a very fixed domain. Whereas now there is the opportunity to access many, many, many more data sets. There's been this absolute explosion in data that are related to a greater or lesser extent to the underlying drivers, economics of companies and economies. And it's finding that link that's important. Hand in hand with that explosion in data is obviously the explosion in computing power. And that opens up new doors, new techniques that we can now exploit and use. Whether it's machine learning or AI, the challenge I think for the industry, and this is where I'd say things have changed or even taken a step back. Back in the day, we would have a real aversion to the idea of black boxes, and quants were associated with their black boxes, and we spent many, many years opening up those boxes and showing exactly how it worked and really making them as transparent as you could. The challenge with the new models we get to build today, the particularly the neural networks and so on, is that they are opaque by construction. And I think it's the new challenge for the industry is how do we open up our black boxes again? How do we explain what we're doing? And I think there are some differences in our industry compared to other industries that ultimately limit what we may be able to do with the technology because of the need for regulation, because of the need for trust, because of the fiduciary responsibility we have, whereby we have to own as individuals the investment decisions we're making, albeit supported by the models that we're building. To what extent are we comfortable taking that responsibility as we build ever more powerful models that are capturing ever more nuance that we may not fully understand?
And do you think that that's a really interesting point about comprehension and human comprehension? We've kind of spent some years talking about this idea, but I mean, when you think about, I suppose, application of quantitative models in financial services, which is a very uncertain domain, essentially. The probability spectrum is still, at best, 55-45 or 53-47, whatever it might look
right.
Like. So this notion of kind of human storytelling becomes important on top of it. And I suppose my question to you is, like, do you think that that's a necessary part of this industry so long as that probability scale stays where it is?
Essentially, I think it's driven by two things. So I think, firstly, people still invest in people. I think it was you, when we were having this conversation a few years back, coined the idea is what happens when our clients become robots, but it feels like we're a way away from that yet. But at the moment, people still invest in people, so we have to be able to explain what we're doing and do that in a compelling fashion, so narrative and stories and examples become important. And we're not going to have the same war stories about the latest, greatest company I visited. It's going to be about the latest, greatest piece of data I've discovered or the latest model we're building. And you've got to convey a passion and be able to explain what's going on. I think the second driver, though, is also actually having a thesis, an economic thesis in your own mind about what your models are trying to do. As you're aware, sort of you can model noise. You can throw enough information and I can model anything, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's telling me any real information. You might find a model might find a relationship between the letter that starts a company's name, companies whose name begins with Z are more volatile than companies that don't. I'm not sure I'd invest on that basis. I want to have an economic thesis.
W, I think, would be the
yes.
word
there. But you need an economic thesis that underpins it. So you're not just doing this because you want to have a compelling narrative. You actually want to be able to explain the fundamental underpinnings of that connects this data set, this data insight with the thing you're trying to model, some sort of forward fundamental future earnings, whatever it might be.
And I think that's always an area I completely agree with you. And I think this idea of kind of increasing our understanding of the way the world functions. And then I go down that track in my mind and I think about, for example, accounting data. So using econometric methods to model accounting data has really been the bread and butter of the vast majority of quant strategies outside of trend following, CTA, that kind of stuff. And even then, perhaps as conditioning agents. So I wouldn't, disregard them, but let's say that you're somewhere in the background. And as we know, accounting data, or the nature of that data, is itself very manufactured. It's a piece of information that is released on a quarterly basis or semi-annual, annual basis, in some cases, by companies. And the amount of twisting and turning that you can do with that, with different methodologies like machine learning, tends to make you feel uncomfortable about data mining the heck out of this thing. On the other hand, there's a sort of a gravity of comfort that this industry has. We're talking about fundamentals and this notion of deviation from fundamentals being something that should be corrected. But we all have very different views as to what fundamentals are. And I mean, I suppose I want to kind of get your sense of, do you think that some of what might happen here is that data science comes in and kind of puts a spotlight back on the kind of empirical relationships that we thought we had established? So the links between sort of fundamental, sort of let's say risk premium returns and all these kinds of things. And so it's actually, you establish those empirical relationships in a very naive, linear kind of way. And the world is much more complicated. It's all one big kind of network and dynamic and whatever. And yeah, accounting data does matter, but it matters in a highly non-linear kind of way. And so therefore, there's this kind of a rediscovery that happens within the quant world. Because at the moment, I don't really seem to see, I suppose, a lot of reimagine. We talked about the difference between, I suppose, when you reimagine the problem versus when you sort of automate
the problem,
an existing kind of solution to that problem. Do you see any kind of wisps or kind of desire to reinvent, the whole nature of mean variance portfolios or factors or anything like that?
So. Just stepping back a second, I guess for sure I would make that sharp distinction between the process of automation, which is powerful and can realize economies and efficiencies, and definitely one should look to push that as far as one can, and actually be able to find new insights, as you say, reframe the problem and so on. And I think there's maybe two ways you can do that. So one is, again, can we find, looking beyond the accounting information, are there now insights I can glean from the network effects or the interactions that might exist? Is that, whether you call it extra financial information or stuff that goes beyond the accounting information that nevertheless tells you something about the prospects for this particular company. I also think there's accounting regulations, accounting disclosures are struggling to keep pace with change in the world. So whether that's the rise of intangibles or simply recognizing that the value enshrined in certain companies is not well reflected on a traditional balance sheet. Digital assets tend not to be reflected. Data assets are certainly not reflected. And that might tempt people to say that the age of value-based investing is over, so value signals don't work. I think that's certainly been a big conversation over the last few years as the value factor seems to have gone unrewarded. But it may just be that the value factor continues to work, it's just that it's not well reflected in a book number or even necessarily a simple trailing 12-month earnings number. So book to price, earnings to price based valuations. And can we find new methods of reflecting that value? Now, that's still an accounting question. I don't want to necessarily frame it in accounting regulation, but can we find new ways to account for companies? Something we've always done is look to restate the accounts of companies to try and make them more consistent, more meaningful. Disclosure varies around the world. Companies make choices as to what and how they choose to disclose things. You need to make those adjustments. That's ripe for automation, and we spent a lot of time automating that. But I do think there's a interesting train of research around, can we find new ways to account for things? Can I scrape the data assets of companies from somewhere and create notional assets? And it's a line of research we're playing with around, again, can I create proxy assets on books to represent, so maybe the data assets, maybe the carbon cost, all these things can be modeled. The trick is to try and find the data set that allows you to proxy these insights. And they're all grounded in this economic hypothesis that there is something of that is value creative or value destructive that the company owns or does, and I want to model that.
And then there's also obviously the secondary step to this, which is about the difference between the traded price and said valuation. So, so in some sense, if you and I came up with two valuation models, we both went away to a room and came back, then perhaps the one of us that would kind of form a business and go on to success is the one that, you know, whose valuation model ended up reflecting the price, as opposed to maybe, you know, the one that truly understood, you know, the nature of that company's, you know, business.
Well, and certainly, yes, ultimately we're all judged in return space. But equally, I could imagine that we'll both come up with models and they'll both have a decent hit rate or batting average, but they may be more effective in different parts of the market or at different periods in the market cycle. And that's the really interesting thing, I think, that's happening in the market at the moment is the fact that the new data, the new modeling techniques actually allow us to create a more diverse set of signals. So one of the challenges we've had as an industry has been this question of quant crowding. You're all building the same signals, so there's a question of crowded trades. I do think that becomes less and less of an issue as we all get to build our slightly more subtle, slightly more nuanced models that capture different things in the marketplace. So, yes, hopefully we can both go on to be successful having built very good models that maybe capture different things.
I guess what I became interested in over time is this notion that we have concepts, so that's value being one of them, and that happens to be the spotlight. But there's a whole bunch of other kind of understood, quote-unquote, risk premium factors that have been defined now as almost like laws of nature that say you must get returns for them, as opposed to kind of alpha strategies or zero-sum games or anything like that. And I do find it interesting because obviously if you define something as a risk premium, it's an equilibrium concept, so it's a 100-year type of thing. So if you only get paid 2 out of 10 years, but you get paid really well in those two, that's still a risk premium. In fact, it's a very reasonable risk premium. And so you can easily get to year 7.5 and think, well, this isn't working anymore. Well, I'm out of business, right? Because you're kind of playing over 100 years. Whereas obviously there's another category of definition where you say, okay, I don't really understand or care about this concept of an equilibrium sort of risk return paradigm, but what I care about is basically generating constant, scalable, incremental returns, which has really been also the bread and butter of the quant manager, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea of the IR, or the Sharpe ratio, reward, stable, steady, you know, steady as she goes returns that you kind of continue to clip coupons, small little coupons along the way with. You might ask, what kind of risk am I getting paid for here? The answer is, what oxygen or whatever is constantly present, right?
For me, that sort of begins to resonate, I start to think about factor timing, because this idea that certain factors work better at certain periods of time, and some of them might be very, very lumpy. And it tends to be the downside is very lumpy, and the upside you can gather. But either way,
escalator, I believe, or something like that.
Yes, and that's a challenge. And obviously, there's a good seam of research at the moment is in factor timing. I've always felt that quantitative analysis plays best when you get to mitigate, diversify your model risk across many, many thousands of opportunities. And that's why stock picking with quant models, I think, you don't need a very high hit rate to be able to diversify away the model risk and actually build a compelling solution. Factor timing with a limited number of factors and quite binary decisions you have to make is harder to model. It doesn't mean we won't be successful in time, but it's a different type of exercise.
But I find it interesting because I guess you could walk down the other path and say, okay, with machine learning or other methodologies, we're going to build hundreds of factors. Yeah, okay, a lot of them are not going to have economic stories, but we're going to diversify across many of them. That's going to be okay. And that's a sin, in some sense, an economic sin to commit. But I think it's a little bit similar to that kind of economic sin where you line up a bunch of companies and you say, you're high value, you're low value, And then you look within the decile of that high value portfolio and you go, actually, yeah, you know what? I'm probably not very good at understanding what your true value is because you're a healthcare company or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, but hey, I need you because I need the diversification from that top tier portfolio versus the bottom tier so that I can kind of get rid of these little idiosyncrasies. So therefore, why could I not build, I don't know, hundreds of models using machine learning and have the same kind of I shouldn't look at it too closely, but hey, if they all kind of bundle together, then I'm okay, and bang, I've built a quantitative hedge fund.
I can absolutely see that. I like the analogy, this idea that sort of like models and quant signals as sort of a universe of investment opportunities. I think we struggle sometimes with our own clients to explain the techniques we're using, and you give stock examples to try and give color to what you're doing. I guess underpinning all of this is the idea that what drives the economics of any investee company, when you buy a share in one company, represents the same thing as a share in another. It's a stake in a stream of future earnings. That doesn't change. When you start trying to build this from a pool of investment signals, to what extent are they really ever comparable in any
It becomes much more abstract. Like you have a portfolio of theorems rather than a portfolio of cupcakes or something.
But if they were, I would argue that the capital markets theoretically are a stationary problem in that, again, what a share represents today should be the same as what it represents tomorrow. We know that as we start looking at individual signals, those are certainly not stationary, I guess I don't see a portfolio of signals as being equivalent to a portfolio of companies
because you see a lot more weight in the companies. Like you kind of look at them and with your accounting lens you kind of see, as you say, real businesses that are generating real money and that you own a piece of that real money flow, right?
And maybe it comes down to that tangibility that I'm familiar enough with the concept of a company and investment and assets and capital and earnings, and it's a much more nebulous idea, this signal. I mean, even for us quants, it becomes...
But that's quite interesting, because let's say if I'm a data scientist, I don't have an accounting background, I don't have an economics background, you're data to me, right? It's just data to me. I have no more grounding in one data stream than another, so I don't have this backdrop that I'm actually modeling a company that is solid, that I can touch, that it has doors, windows, employees, etc. In that situation, I suppose... what becomes relevant, or the weight of what I think about, is the nature of that, of the system I'm building and the algorithm I'm building versus the tangibility of the thing I'm working with.
Does it even matter, the tangibility? And maybe therein lies the problem. And it's almost why I think that pure data scientists, I think it's dangerous to approach quantitative investing as a pure data scientist. I think you absolutely need the fundamental underpinnings because of the non-stationary nature of how the information, the data, ultimately plays out in return space. And why you end up being tempted to go down a path of, well, I'm going to keep using this signal until it stops working. I think a fundamental question you should ask yourself is, why has it stopped working? What is it that has stopped working? And again, we're living in a regulated world where we have to be able to own and explain our investment decisions. I'm much more comfortable in a world where I force myself to ground my investment signals in sort of a fundamental conversation about what drives earnings, as opposed to just trying to data mine a signal and not being able to explain why it does or isn't going to exist in the future.
I 100% agree with you. I think I 100% agree with you. And the only thing that makes me pause about that type of approach, not in a bad way, but in a kind of how do I overcome this, is the other element of this, of the concave function, which is story mining.
Right.
So when you kind of go, look, here's a random snowflake that's landed on my left hand, here's the one that landed on my right hand, and then I'm going to tell you a story about why that happened. And I think for people that have intelligence and ability to argue through analogy and metaphor and all these kinds of ideas, which I think species like us in that universe do, there's this always kind of a self-temperament to go, okay, I could come across as really certain I'm explaining something, but actually, if I didn't have to explain it, I would say, on the margin, I probably just don't know.
look, I think the one thing our industry is absolutely in desperate need of is an element of humility. And look, we've lived through enough quant crashes and quant crises to hopefully develop that humility. Once again, grounding stuff in fundamentals at least gives you an anchor on which you can begin to have those conversations with, whether it's with consultants or with clients or your colleagues, about why we're doing what we're doing, why it works or why it doesn't work. And I think that anchor gives me comfort as an investor.
Because it's so interesting, we had this conversation previously with one of the other guests we had here, Linda, regarding, again, this notion that the industry, and by this is like a group of people somewhere in the woods we're kind of pointing to here, anonymously.
Yes.
Them over there. Basically, kind of the way they talk about the markets and these highly uncertain outcomes is with a great deal of confidence and therefore a great deal of communicated certainty. Mm. Whereas I think statisticians, mathematicians think about the world as a kind of highly improbable, highly difficult to forecast problem, highly chaotic, highly random issue, where you're really striving for inches, essentially. It's a game of inches. And that's really all of your work and your expertise and your technical knowledge and the people you have and the data systems you have are about inching out a few more. And I think if you're an investor or you're somebody who's grown up in this industry and you're used to listening to people more on the kind of mainstream media channels, you assume the level of certainty in the world regarding financial outcomes is 80% or 75% just by listening to the vocals. Then somebody comes in with a statistical, mathematical, quantitative background who goes, actually, no, I know much less about the world, and the world is nowhere near as secure. And I'm sure that there's a moment where you kind of think to yourself, well, does that mean you're not as skillful as that person who has, like, you know, this wonderful self-confidence about them?
I actually think it's not as bad as all that. I do think there's a greater understanding about the nature of risk. What does it mean when you're looking at statistics? So I've found that that's become an easier conversation over time. I don't hesitate to share the hit rate of our models and recognize that that may not sound compelling set against the confidence of an individual judgmental stock picker. But at the end of the day, we can actually go and quantify that confidence in a very real sense. And I think it comes through in results as well. And so again, hopefully you can demonstrate that difference through the results. The challenge we often have is that you're trying to do that over very short periods of time where distinguishing skill from luck becomes essentially a technical question. Again, this is not just what does it mean and how much confidence should you ascribe to this track record you're sharing or so on. But I do find those conversations have got easier. Now, maybe it's the self-selecting the types of meetings we get to have as quants, meeting with certain types of clients and certain types of consultants, where they can have a real conversation around the maths and stats behind it. But I think society as a whole is beginning to get to grips with the idea that the world is an uncertain place and actually you need to quantify that. Maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part. I'm just thinking as I think through the politics that we're living through at the moment.
No, well, I mean, I guess when we're sitting here and we kind of all of us are in our bubbles, right? Our quant bubbles, and we kind of think about the world as, I suppose, slightly better solution if we have at least an awareness of how difficult or uncertain the world is, and then we kind of try and improve it from that starting point rather than another one. But I do wonder, as I look upon this newer sub-industry, and that sub-industry on that, because it's small actually, it's probably bigger than quant by now, data science, that's kind of coming through, and the enthusiasm and the energy and the wonderful human resource and intelligence that's going into it, and the amount of sharing, and I kind of make comparisons or kind of differences with our industry, which is a bit more secretive, a bit more introverted, but having kind of gone through many more hard knocks and hard blows because the problem set is so difficult.
Yes.
And I've said this before, but I think that as a force for change, I think the quantitative discipline, if it ever was going to, I think has failed in kind of transforming our industry to be more structurally more systematic. If you consider the amount of academics and intelligence that has gone to this industry, I suppose, and you still turn on the television and you don't see a single conversation about factor investing, or very few, let's say, a little bit more now, but you know, or any kind of uncertainty of outcomes, or you don't have the type of speakers or conversationalists that are able to kind of portray that type of uncertainty and kind of scientific approach to this difficult problem set.
I'm interested in what you're saying. There is a cultural shift that has to happen within our industry, nebulous, anonymous industry, where, again, we're coming from a world 20, 30, 40 years ago of star fund managers who were with brains the size of a planet, who you trust, and it's all about engendering trust, and they'll be telling you those war stories in review meetings and so on. And we're trying to bring an industry to get comfortable with the statistics and the confidence levels and characterizing the fact that this edge is really just a factor, and there are good factors and bad factors and better factors and worse factors, and that it's a different conversation. Different markets around the world, I think, are at different stages in that conversation. So certainly it's an easier conversation in certain places. That's why I spend a lot of time in Australia, because I do think the market here is open to these ideas and concepts. I think there's a wider question for society around this idea of openness and sharing and leveraging the power of collective endeavor versus building an edge and building a proprietary edge and non-disclosure and secrecy and so on. And I compare our own industry to, say, software development and the world of GitHub and Bitbucket and so on, where, again, it becomes an issue when you hire developers and they want to share the code they're writing with others, and that's because culturally that's what they're used to, and nevertheless we want to somehow protect proprietary insights that we're building. I think there's a balance to be struck, and it's not going to just face our industry. Every industry will need to have that conversation as they work out how do we leverage the opportunities that a shared collaborative working environment, whatever that may be, powered by the internet, how do we leverage that as society whilst also allowing individual endeavor and individual reward to make sure that we're motivated to actually spend our time contributing to this.
And I think there's such a rich area of conversation, especially, I guess, as we become a more mature industry, especially in the West, probably more so than the East, when it comes to asset management, and there's people much more in their 30s, 40s and 50s working in this industry happily, being an expert in their particular area, whether that be kind of coding or data or a client presentation or whatever. And this notion that, you know, at some point in history, there was this notion of get rich quick. You go into asset management, Wolf of Wall Street type of idea, and you sell, you make lots of money, you crash and burn, or you win, or nothing in between. Whereas now you've got these kind of long-term tenured career professionals in various different areas who are very thoughtful, very kind of steady, but they don't necessarily want to become A, the superstars or CEOs, and B, they're really comfortable and very good at expertise in their area. And I suppose when it comes to specifically to data science, I mean, the other area that you kind of touched on, which is an interesting one, which is, you know, asset management typically, outside of a few industries, and I think Australia has a really interesting model where the asset owner industry is really friendly with each other. They share a lot of information,
right.
Even though they're probably going to be starting to compete a lot more. So we'll see where that goes. But, compared to, let's say, if you go to an average quant conference, I mean, no one has any incentive to get up on stage and talk about what they're doing at all. So often they kind of struggle to find speakers or other panels, so they end up getting, I don't know, your average sell-side quant or somebody from a data background going, talking about stuff, but everybody's sitting there taking notes, kind of hiding it from everybody else, kind of looking
there's,
down.
There's no incentive to stand out. These panels, everybody agrees with each other because, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So this idea of a zero-sum game, I suppose, when you've got an industry where you've got a competitive environment and your competition, you know, makes you do better than me, etc. I feel like maybe in those industries, you're going to have a limit to their sharing. And I'm guessing we're already going to see that in governments, and Secret Service and various other kind of institutions. If you think about the rise of AI in those areas, whether that's automated warfare, whether you think about intelligence gathering, etc., I fail to see many data science conferences talking about intelligence gathering practices and let's share them kind of thing.
Yeah, they don't stick it up on GitHub.
Well, I think it's called WikiLeaks. That
right,
one.
Indeed.
That's the other one. But I mean, going back to this idea of the culture of it, I think you make an interesting point. So obviously, I mean, Rosenberg has a very long and proud and interesting history regarding quantitative management, and it's been through many different phases and cycles. I suppose in that most recent cycle where you've got people coming into this organization, the millennials, Zennials, etc., who have this kind of data science DNA to them, I mean, how do you think about, even for a quant shop, which are meant to be talking about the same language and have the same ideas, how easy or difficult is it to bring that type of expertise, that data science expertise, into a quantitative shop?
So I think that the it's really interesting what motivates them and what's the most exciting thing you can offer them beyond compensation. And as we know, the little dirty secret of quant generally is actually getting hold of data in the first place, tidying your data before you get to start doing any analysis is more than half the problem. You spend 80% of the time doing that before you get to spend 80% of your time building the models. So What I do think is we do find as an attractive or as an incentive is providing people a data playground, having access to all this information that's already been cleaned, already been refined, and there's lots of it. And that immediately allows people to hit the ground running to do the stuff that's really interesting, as opposed to trying to tidy the data. So that's been definitely part of it. I think the other thing is to create an environment where people feel close to the money, or close to the decision making, or close to clients. They can see the impact of their work on outcomes for clients. And so you don't lock your data scientists away in a room, or you don't want to have your research center separate from the rest of the business. And it's something we've learned over the years. How do you bring your research teams close to your portfolio management teams? You blur the edges. Your portfolio managers hopefully are all skilled data manipulators, or understand enough about data science, or can code enough to play with the information. The researchers are exposed to client outcomes and spend time actually looking at client portfolios, not just building an abstract signal. And that's a cultural, organizational challenge, far more than a technology or technical challenge. And it evolves over time. It's hard to get right day one. Being small helps, makes that easier. Building cross-functional teams, building flat organizations where there's less emphasis on hierarchy, all of that allows that collaboration and cross-fertilization of ideas.
You were going to use the word agile a moment ago. I was almost going to go there.
almost going to go there. A word that is very much overused and abused.
Exactly.
As we talk about,
we're all Scrum Masters in our own mind.
Absolutely.
But I mean, that's an interesting one, because I think most businesses in the world that are struggling with the notion of AI, including financial services, don't have that bedrock of a quantitative systematic data platform. They certainly don't have the critical mass of other similarly minded folk. And it's interesting for me to hear, I guess, from you that even when you do have that, there is still work to be done to bring in these teams and to kind of, because I could imagine your latest, greatest data science hire comes in and goes, right, I want to share my code on GitHub. I'm going to create this brand new, you know, machine learning nonlinear model. And I don't know the economic story, but does that really matter? You know, like, it's those type of conversations where you kind of have to realign them and say, well, no, I'll take the OLS, I'll take the linear model over the machine learning.
Yes.
If you only give me, like, I don't know, an incremental uplift, but no story, essentially. My story has a sort of some value in the uplift, essentially.
And that's, one of the things we have realized is the value of stories. And again, for all of our signals tend to be incremental. It's very, very rare that you come up with the silver bullet that makes this massive material difference. But hopefully it's a combination of things that build up over time. But for sure, they often have a nice, strong narrative associated with them, which it's important that clients understand what they're investing in. If you can bring that to life with some interesting stories, that gives them some comfort level. But yes, I think those conversations do continue to evolve. It's not that we've solved the culture problem. It's just that new challenges arise. And it is something about the flat organization that allows people to have exposure to other ideas in a safe way. It's not that my thoughts and views are secondary to the fund managers, or that I have to bow to the quant models. It's this ongoing conversation, and as you and I both know, the models don't get it right all the time. And one of the questions you'll always want to have is, what is the role of the warm bodies and the portfolio managers in overseeing, governing? What is the nature of that oversight? When do you step in? How much discipline do you have? You want to make sure you're not throwing away your quantitative edge and insight, or diluting that. But you also want to hopefully add value through that process of rigorous monitoring.
And this idea of the human in the loop, I suppose, is the equivalent in data science world, where you have some cooperation between data and models and people. And I always found that that's a very alluring idea, because, well, there's a little bit of self-aggrandizing by humans to go, yep, I'm still important. I'm still AlphaGo, still needs me.
Absolutely.
And that always feels good. I'm not going to, you know, replace too quickly. But I think it also requires a very specific type of mindset. I get the sense, I mean, having read Super Forecasting a couple of times now, and that fast becoming my kind of latest, greatest. It has become my Bible, I think, over the last couple of years, because I just see examples of it everywhere. This idea of that slow, meticulous, weight of probability reasoning that you can have as a human being if you're very disciplined, if you're very thoughtful, if you have a lot of time and energy to do so. and then incrementally bringing in tools to help you with that type of thinking, aka quant models or ML or whatever, feels like near where these two things meet. I think we've both heard terms like quantamental,
yes,
please shoot me now, where, you know, there's this ideal of the human intuition looking for that exception or that outlier or whatever, and then you marry that with this kind of big nameless server that's blinking and telling you what on average things should be, and then, you know, you're kind of left to your own devices as to how you can't, you know, kind of negotiate this too.
So perhaps, but the quantum mental is a bad thing. I mean, I have no problem with the term, but that's because, as I say, when I approach quantum investing, it's not that I see that as the link of man, people and machines, or mortals and machines. I think it's about the quantity, the fundamental underpinning and rigorous economic thought you want to bring to your models, be that completely machine-driven or otherwise. And apologies, I forgot we were going on that quantum mental. The key word, and we mentioned it before, is this idea of humility, though. So yes, I have a role. I want to justify my existence as a warm body sitting here alongside this blinking computer. But I do need a healthy dose of humility, recognizing what is it that I'm doing each and every day in that monitoring process, and maybe just recognizing that sometimes a computer could do that just as well.
And I think for me, certainly, and we've, you know, done a lot of these kind of presentations together, where we kind of talk about machine learning and then the usefulness. And on the one hand, there's this kind of pragmatic, how do we understand things better? But there's another thing, there's this kind of a niggling suspicion in the back of our minds that basically says, maybe it can see something that we can't see. And what does that kind of mean?
For me, that just makes me excited. As I said, I definitely operate at the sharp end where I think computers will be able to make better informed decisions than me. And that's not, that doesn't just apply to our industry. Across the board, things that involve spotting patterns in stuff, the gut feeling you have in your stomach is simply you subconsciously seeing some pattern of information out there. And I do think computers can do a very good job of seeing those patterns. That doesn't worry me, though. I do think that, for me, it's best characterized in what I was told when I joined the company day one. I was told in absolutely no uncertain terms that my job was to make myself redundant. Look at what I was doing day in, day out, and automate it away, and we'll find you something more interesting to do. And over the course of my career, there has always been something more interesting to do as we think about new data sets that I can share with the models to see if we can make better investment decisions, understanding what's going on in markets and see if we can build ever more sophisticated models that capture some of those new interactions or new forms of valuation. So I'm not worried that we're going to be redundant anytime soon. We'll get to do more fun, more interesting stuff while the computers pick up the heavy work.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful idealism, and I think it's probably a wonderful way to think about the future. And that brings me probably to my last question for you, because you're a busy man, which is, you know, if you kind of look across the spectrum, and we both do a lot of reading in AI and the different kinds of cool technologies coming out and what the possibilities are, and, you know, all the kind of slightly worrying ones as well as the exciting ones. But is there any thoughts you have regarding what you think are probably the biggest threats or opportunities when it comes to the application of AI in society, so much broader outside of financial services than when you kind of think about our generation and next generation to come?
So the optimist that I am, I tend to fixate more on the opportunities than the threats. And for me, the most interesting stuff I'm reading at the moment is around work that's being done on the explicability of models. And it comes back to this idea that I don't want to build black boxes, but more than that, I get excited when I begin to understand what a model is doing, and you realize quite how powerful or clever it is, that actually excites me. And so there's some really interesting work being done at the moment on actually not just having models make predictions, but also being able to have them explain their predictions. And I think that's going to create a watershed moment in society as we all collectively trust the machines that much more and trust the AI that's out there. And that's going to be a transformative effect on society.
It'd be the biggest clever clogs you've ever had in your life. Your phone will explain to you why you're wrong all the time about anything you thought.
You might not want to sit next to it at a dinner party, but nevertheless, I'm very happy it being my accountant, my lawyer, my investment manager.
Let's see how we go. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time, Gideon, today.
Thank you for having the conversation. It was really fun.
Cheers.
Thanks.